those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof. Ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy Wince-Free Whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for two shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White. A whiter smile without the wince.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first round of relief for Hurricane Katrina was heroic in spots, desperately needed all over, and ultimately it appeared an operational failure. But the needs of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast and the effort to meet them go on. Now fueled by billions from American pockets and the American Treasury, Americans have donated more than $800 million in a matter of days. Congress and the president are pushing in billions more. President Bush is back in the region today. But families are still looking for loved ones, homes, work, and their next meal. This hour on Point, we want to look at what all that money is doing, at the relief effort now, who's okay, who's not, and the new challenges of Katrina. We begin in the Gulf Coast for the latest on what's happening on the ground. Chris Axman has been in New Orleans and across Louisiana for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from Baton Rouge. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Joyner is in Gulfport, Mississippi for the Clarion Ledger, Jackson, Mississippi's daily newspaper. Chris Joyner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Chris, first to you, if I may, in Gulfport, how's it look? How's the relief effort going? Give us a kind of status picture.
Well, it's very busy and has been for a number of days down here. It's sort of officially moved from relief into recovery, so you're seeing a lot of debris removal. Just for Harrison County, which is Biloxi and Gulfport, they estimate it's going to be $200 million in debris removal costs alone. So that's the stage we're in right now. And the Mississippi Department of Transportation is moving quickly to open up U.S. 90. They hope to have that reopened in a couple of months, and that's the main thoroughfare that runs along the Gulf Coast.
And what about people? We know New Orleans was evacuated. Where you are in Gulfport, what percentage of people are without homes? Where are they? How are they getting along?
It's a strange story because in some ways we think that evacuations were a lot less than for previous hurricanes that did much less damage.
Mm-hmm.
We do have, I think upwards of 2,000 people in just the Biloxi and Gulfport area that are still in some of the public schools used as hurricane shelters. That's expected to come to an end this week as FEMA moves in some temporary housing units, but that hasn't been moving quick enough for anyone. Really.
And what about jobs? Are people back at jobs? Is there any indication at this point of what portion of the economy has been kind of erased here, what portion of jobs are simply gone for the moment?
Well, for some cities, some of the smaller cities like Pas Christian and Waveland, what had been their commercial base is gone entirely. For larger cities like Biloxi and Gulfport, you're seeing some of the service industries come online pretty quickly to mainly serve the relief effort, like restaurants, for instance.
Right. Chris Axman, you've been across Louisiana and in New Orleans, and we're trying to get a handle on just how things stand. It's only a couple of days ago that the governor, Kathleen Blanco, who we just heard speaking in the top of the hour news, now speaking in a very warm way about President Bush, who, of course, is in the region today and will speak tonight about rebuilding. We'll talk about rebuilding tomorrow. But on this relief and recovery effort, Governor Blanco was saying just a couple days ago that they didn't even have enough help to recover the bodies of the storm yet, that she was going to lose the services of the body removal firm out of Houston that had been picking up bodies. She needed someone else to come in and help her. At that very basic level, are there still bodies floating?
Not that you can see as you're driving about and out with folks who are still checking on residents. A lot of the area is drying out. There's probably about 40% of the city that's still underwater. Many of the bodies that were just laying about have already been picked up earlier this week. They made efforts to do that, but it was sort of chaotic even at that level. You know, about 15 different agencies would depend on one body and remove it. So it's still pretty chaotic in terms of how things are getting done.
Mayor Ray Nagin, who we heard so much from in the midst of the agony right after the storm, saying that the French Quarter may reopen Monday. Now, we know that wasn't seriously flooded. We've all seen that on TV. On the other hand, New Orleans was largely emptied. Where are those people now? And is it possible to generalize about their status?
Yes, in fact, we are hearing that Monday, the areas like Uptown, the Garden District, French Quarter, those folks may be allowed back in for the first time. I can tell you that we were there earlier this week, and we wandered around those areas that are dried out, and people were already coming, just using their driver's licenses to get back in and look around and check out their homes and that kind of thing. And so I think once they are allowed back in, then the numbers are going to be substantially increased in terms of who's driving about. It's still very difficult to get around because of all the debris. And so having all those people on the roads is going to be even more chaotic.
Now, you're in Baton Rouge. Of course, hundreds of thousands were displaced from New Orleans. Can you see clear evidence of that in Baton Rouge?
Absolutely. This poor town has doubled in size since the hurricane.
Wow.
And the freeways and every major street are just choked with traffic. You know, the restaurants are just filled to the brim, and hotels are totally booked for months at a time. Not only evacuees, but, you know, contractors who are using this as a hub to go in and out of New Orleans.
And what about relief agencies? Are there big tents set up? Are they still occupying schools and churches? What about the people who don't have the means to be in a hotel? How are they being cared for?
Well, a lot of these shelters have been consolidated, and what they've done is moved people into either apartments or they haven't got the temporary housing up and running, but they were talking about it a couple days ago, and so they're moving towards getting folks into trailers and sort of campground type situations. But as it stands now, people are just sort of dispersed wherever they can find a spot.
Chris Joyner, what about the relief effort, the relief agencies there in Gulfport? Is it very evident? Americans have opened their pockets and pocketbooks like never before in history, at speed in this case. Can you see the evidence of that on the ground?
Yes, and particularly when it comes to some of the real basic supplies like food and water and ice. There's an ample supply of that now, and that's made a big difference for the people who didn't leave. You're also seeing lots of smaller groups and individuals that are donating supplies like clothing and diapers and that kind of thing. In fact, some of that has become a problem. Some local emergency management people have been dispatched to clean up piles of clothing that's just been dumped in parking lots at this stage. I think that the real issue here is housing. I said earlier that a couple of thousand people were in shelters, but that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of people who are living in tents in their front yards or, you know, multiple families staying under one roof someplace. It's a serious, serious issue for this area.
And Chris Axman, there in Baton Rouge, I mean, we're looking at this, billions coming from Congress, we're told, and we'll talk about later in the hour, but also more than $800 million from Americans, $312 million of that, we read, donated by corporations, foundations, wealthy individuals. John Grisham, the Southern author, thriller writer, and his wife donated $5 million. T. Boone Pickens and Leona Helmsley each gave $5 million. Do you see that money picking people up and responding to their actual needs here 2 weeks and change after the storm?
Not really. I'm not seeing evidences of it yet. I mean, I do think that money is going to go into housing for the most part, and that's the most critical need. But we were along the West Bank yesterday and into some of the towns, the suburban areas of New Orleans, and what they're saying is they still feel like, even though they were devastated by the storm as well, they may not have gotten flooding, they sort of feel like they're still waiting around for FEMA, waiting around for the Red Cross. So it's a little hit or miss where you're finding the aid getting to.
And Mayor Nagin says in a couple of weeks he anticipates there may be 180,000 people back in New Orleans. That leaves a lot of people outside New Orleans. Do you have a sense of long-term plans being drawn up for jobs, for work? We've heard about school. We know they're trying to get kids into the schools wherever they've landed. But do you see, you know, rungs on a ladder that people can grab onto to climb out of this hole?
I think that the suburban towns, like I said, are really emphasizing. Their parish presidents and mayors are saying, everyone, please get back and get your businesses up and running, get your homes ready, because we need to be the first line of help for New Orleans. And we also were in Houston last week and saw the enormous efforts going on there to get people jobs, to get people into houses and back into schools. So it's happening across the country.
Chris, give us a sense just at the very personal level of what you see in people's faces today as opposed to a week ago when it was just complete disarray. Are people pulling themselves together? Do you see folks just still disheveled and stumbling around? What's the mood?
In New Orleans?
Well, New Orleans in your travels across Louisiana.
Okay. I'd say it's, I wouldn't say relief, but I would say sort of resignation to the fact that this is going to be an ongoing situation for quite a while. And so they have begun to look for homes. We were at a place yesterday where an RV center where they've sold, you know, every single RV they had on the lot except five. And so people are finally realizing that this is going to be the situation for a long time. They need to deal with finding jobs, finding homes, and they are strong about it for the most part.
And Chris Axman, we've just got 20 seconds here. Determination, depression, what are you seeing there in Gulfport?
Chris Joyner, actually.
Excuse me, yes.
I've remarked from the very beginning that I'm impressed with the steel these communities have shown. These are tight-knit communities, and they're working-class and lower-class communities to a large extent, and they've long since learned to rely on each other and their families, and that hasn't changed.
Happening right now. Chris Joyner in Gulfport, Mississippi, and Chris Axman in Baton Rouge are grateful to each of you for being with us. We are talking this hour about the Gulf Coast relief effort, where it stands now after the first stumbling response. What do you see? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the relief effort now after the rough first response to Katrina. Who's okay, who's not, and whether we're finally getting on top of this situation. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Has the nation finally got a handle on this effort? Are you hearing from friends, from family, from relief workers in the Gulf Coast area? What are they saying? Are the needs finally being met? And what's next? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want to keep wading into these waters, and we're glad to hear some of them are receding, but there's a lot of debris and a lot of water and a lot of woe still to be worked through here. Joining us from Jackson, Mississippi, is Mario Flores, Director of Disaster Relief for Habitat for Humanity. He's coordinated disaster relief efforts from around the world, including in Indonesia after the tsunami. Mario Flores, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Portland, Oregon, Neil Kenny Geyer, CEO of Mercy Corps, an international aid organization with operations in 35 countries. They have a dozen people on the Gulf Coast now, millions at work down there. He's been involved in relief work for 25 years. Neil Kenny Geyer, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Mario Flores, let's speak to housing first. Habitat for Humanity, famous for doing that, but we've got very, very immediate needs here. Are you at all involved in the immediate housing of people there? How do you assess the housing needs right now? How are you beginning to dig in?
Yes, in fact, housing needs are really, you know, overwhelming at this point. But because of our mandate, Habitat for Humanity, pretty much we focus on the long-term, you know, permanent housing after the very first phases of search and rescue and relief stages have concluded. So at this point, what we are actually doing is making assessment and trying to check on our local affiliates. As you may know, we work with local chapters of volunteers and
right.
people who become involved around the cause of building you know, permanent long-term housing for people who are actually living in poverty housing. So the needs are overwhelming. That I don't think anybody can argue against that. Needs were very high, actually, before the hurricane, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the hurricane just exacerbated, you know, the conditions of poverty housing along the Gulf Coast.
So we're hearing about trailer cities that may be put up, and, of course, evacuees at this point are all over the country. Many states have opened doors. What are you doing with Habitat for Humanity? Are you looking for sites, for lots, where you begin to build houses with local help? Is that how you approach it? How do you find a place to build?
Yes. The way we approach it is we're working together with our affiliates who were in the area before the hurricane. We are actively looking for land, and let me tell you that is going to be probably one of the biggest issues here. We're also assessing, you know, how building permits and ordinances and zoning ordinances may change in the future because of the storm. And we're also doing research on how building codes are going to be modified in front of the results of the hurricane.
So the planning to dig in on needs that are urgent right now, Habitat for Humanity will swing in there in time, but we can hear how you're putting the pieces together. Neil Kenny-Geyer, in Portland, you've been in this business of relief for a long time. If you step back and look at the arc of this relief effort, here we are going on 3 weeks since Katrina came ashore. We all saw how bad it was in the first week and more. Where would you describe this relief effort as being at now in that arc?
Well, it's in the very early phases of recovery, but in many ways that the arc of relief and recovery really reflects what we see in disasters around the world. You almost always have early chaos. You almost always have communication challenges. You always have the compassion imperatives, which are to immediately, for those who have survived, provide shelter, food and clean water, and health care. And then you always have the coordination challenges. And we've seen that in abundance in this case. And in some cases, I think they've been more aggravated than in the kinds of challenges we've faced overseas. The finally is that we also see that you can't think of relief and recovery as sequential phases. You really have to think of it as phases that occur simultaneously depending on where the people are. There are still people now who need relief, who are dependent upon basic food, shelter, health care. But then there are people, as the reporters pointed out, who are already engaged in recovery. And finally, in some of the suburbs, people are beginning the reconstruction process. And we have to be prepared to attack all three phases at the same time.
So multiple tracks are going to be running here. I don't want to go past that most basic and initial one that's still going on at many levels, the what you call the compassion imperatives. You've got a lot of people in the field. What are they telling you? At this point, is everybody housed and fed? And I mean, everybody's a big word, but are the compassion imperatives being met?
Most people are being fed. Most people are getting clean water now. Most people are having access to some level of health care. There are still shelter challenges. There are still too many people who are in large shelters, living in cots, side by side in way overcrowded conditions. And there's a big challenge to move those people into some form of transitional housing as we begin to plan for their permanent needs. But thankfully, at this stage, most of the basic needs are being met.
I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation. I have a feeling that they've got information of their own to share with us. Nicole's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Nicole, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I actually, it's interesting that the comment that the gentleman just made, what I wanted to mention, speaks directly to that. I used to live in New Orleans. I was a teacher there for about 3 years, and the woman who was my aide in my classroom, she and I became incredibly close. I'm very close with her family. And
How are they doing? What are you hearing?
Well, they have somehow, her entire extended family, they somehow managed to all, they had been completely dispersed. Some were sleeping on a bridge for days in the city, some were in hotels, some were in the Superdome, some were in, they evacuated to Houston and to Mississippi.
Have they found one another?
Yeah, they've somehow found one another. The vast majority of them ended up in a shelter in LaPorte, Texas, outside of Houston. Some of them have relocated to San Antonio, and some of them are actually moved into an apartment. But one of the things that she was saying yesterday, she was kind of laughing about it. She said, you know, everywhere I go, people are trying to give me food. And she's like, you know, there's only so much food I can eat. I really need clothes, and I need somewhere to live, and I'm going to need appliances when I get in the house.
Does she have a sense of where she's going to live yet? Will she be one of those 180,000 that Mayor Ray Nagin is anticipating will come back to New Orleans? Or are they going to relocate? Temporary housing? What?
Well, we're there's actually a map that is a hybrid map. I think it's a Google map that if you click on it, it can tell you exactly at the intersection how much estimated water was there at its highest point.
How many feet depth, that sort of thing, yeah?
Yeah, and so what we can tell, if this map is accurate, around her, the area where she lived, it only got up to about 2 to 3 feet of water.
Mm-hmm.
And so she thinks that their house might be okay, or she's hoping. So if, her children, she has five children, ranging from 19 years old to one, and they are actually enrolled in the schools now.
And are you hearing still the kind of panic of emergency in her voice or something else, another phase clicking in here, Nicole?
Well, I think that sort of the shock is starting to wear off, and it's more frustration that, like, she wants to sort of pick up and move on, but she feels like she's without resources, and people are trying to help her out, but it's a very difficult process. So she wants more than anything to get reestablished, to get into her own place, mm-hmm. you know, to get some stability for her family so that they can, if they're going to only be there for a year or two, you know, establish themselves. I think ultimately they would like to go back to New Orleans, but, but she doesn't know what's going to happen. So
hooking up those resources with the people who need them and the way they need them. Nicole, thanks very much for sharing that story with us. I want to stay close to people who are plugged in to those who have been evacuated, who have been dispersed by the flood. We're joined right now from Boston by Rhody Chambliss. She was born and raised in New Orleans. Her family's evacuated to Mississippi, Texas, and Baton Rouge. We've talked to her several times since Katrina came ashore. We're glad to have her back. Rhody Chambliss, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
So we've been kind of following your family through you. We're looking this hour at how the relief effort's going. Are your dispersed family members getting what they need to get back on their feet? How do you see what's going on?
Well, in talking to family members that are in Louisiana, in Baton Rouge, and then also in Texas and in Mississippi,
yeah.
We're hearing different stories in terms of whether or not they've gotten assistance and how much assistance. And the people who are in Baton Rouge, which is closest to where everything happened and where there's probably the largest number of people, they actually have not received the same assistance as the people in Texas and Mississippi, and we don't really know why.
Where are they staying, Rhody? Your family in Baton Rouge?
Staying with family members, and I also don't, know if it has to do with the fact that they're not hooked into the official shelters, or if they were in those shelters, if the situation would be different, but from what we're hearing, they haven't gotten, you know, assistance, and the stories are very different from what we're hearing from people in Texas.
And when you say assistance, what do you mean? Food, clothes,
well,
cash? What is it that they need that they don't have?
The people in Texas have received financial assistance in order to get temporary housing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, too, just to make a note, the people in Texas are people whose houses were completely submerged, and
right.
they're the ones who are wondering if they're going to go back or not.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the people in Louisiana, their houses were damaged less, and they fully intend to go back, and they don't want to go too far away from their property, and those are the ones that have not received financial assistance for temporary housing for a few months, which is what they're trying to do. And actually, they have benefited from, you know, people's personal, from direct help from friends and
mm-hmm.
families and coworkers from other people. So it's people have been very generous, but it'd be interesting to know, like, how the official distribution is happening and kind of comparing it across areas.
Yeah, we're going to try and do that. Rhody Chambliss, you've always been a clear-eyed observer for us, and we wish your family well in all those locations, and we thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Rhody Chambliss, native of New Orleans, with a lot of family down there right now. Neil Kenny-Geyer, what do you hear in those two reports from our listeners and friends in the field?
Well, I hear that, we who are in the aid business have got a lot of important work to do, not the least of which is to do a better job at getting information out to people wherever they are. We had one of our own most seasoned veterans of Relief, who led our efforts in Aceh after the tsunami, is from New Orleans.
That's in Sumatra, Indonesia. He led your efforts.
That's right, Sumatra, Indonesia, and Aceh. And she came from Indonesia to New Orleans because her family, her parents, were forced from their home. And for her, it was so important to get back into New Orleans and assess the damages with her family so that she could plan a course forward. And we're going to have to do that for hundreds of thousands of people. They're not going to be able to come back with their families intact. We've got to provide a non-bureaucratic, effective way so that people can assess their damages, have one-stop shopping with good information for what their options are, so that they can quickly make decisions, because the more quickly that they can make decisions, the more quickly they can get their lives settled, their kids back in schools, and decide what their course of life is going to be over the 12 months, the better it will be for everyone.
Let me ask you about this wave of money that's headed toward the Gulf Coast. We're reading now more than $830 million in private donations from Americans, and that doesn't even begin to look at the government money, which we will look at. Just for the Red Cross, after the tsunami, 2.5 weeks after the South Asian tsunami, they had raised $173 million. At this same period after Katrina, they have raised more than $650 million. Do you have the sense, Neil Kinnegar, that the money that people are just generously pushing toward this problem is getting allocated where it needs to go, is getting the people in need?
Well, I think for the most part it is. I'm sure we'll hear stories where it's not. But for the most part, the Red Cross obviously is set up, and they're the go-to agency for short-term emergency relief in this country. And frankly, they have way more capacity in this country than they do in overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, like all of us, they have been overwhelmed by the magnitude and scale of the needs. But from what we've observed, they've done their best under the circumstances to organize to meet the needs the best they can. Then there are groups like my own, Mercy Corps, and other organizations that typically work overseas, but because of the scale of this disaster and because local authorities, federal authorities, state authorities were so overwhelmed in the early days, we felt compelled to bring our expertise to bear as well. And we've got some of our most seasoned veterans down there on the ground ensuring that the aid, to the best of our ability, reaches the most vulnerable people in an efficient manner.
Let's take another call. Tara's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Tara. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What do you see? What do you know?
Well, after pacing for a few days and leaving my name with, I would say, about 20 volunteer lines who could do nothing with me, I found some people that wanted to send a truck down to people that weren't being served.
And what did you put on that truck, and did it get down?
For the first truck was everything, clothes and toiletries, emergency medical supplies, light bulbs, you name it.
And did it get to people who needed those things? Do you know what happened at the other end?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. We found lots of phone calls, lots of people making phone calls. We found several shelters and a organization that was probably serving 100 pop-up shelters that was supposedly supposed to be getting Red Cross aid, and they hadn't gotten a Band-Aid a week after the hurricane, and we were sending stuff FedEx. And the first time, when the box arrived, people said that people were practically in tears, and they said, but this is kind of a joke. You know, we're serving thousands of people, and we really appreciate your box of Band-Aids, you know, and your bottle of alcohol and your box of tampons. But,
yeah.
So we started shipping ground, and that was getting really expensive, $50 a box,
kidding.
A few boxes. So we decided to send a semi to that one region, thinking that we were going to have to send three or four semis, and actually that one semi seems to satisfy the Lafayette region. We have a warehouse there. People can walk in anytime they want. Otto's Angels in that region is satisfying it. So anybody that wants to get anything out of that warehouse, go to www.ottosangels.com. That's in the Lafayette. They're actually in New Iberia. And
pick up what you need. That is an amazing story, Tara.
We're moving on. We're not done. We have two trucks ready to roll. We're going to roll another one probably Sunday night, and that's going to go to Baton Rouge. And we got one probably going to either Gulfport or Lake Charles, depending on what we find out who needs what. We're moving on to school books now. We're going to do a school book drive. That's not Otto's Angels. You'll have to write to me directly. Can I read my number, my name over, my number?
Very quickly, yeah.
978-266-2778, and we're doing a drive for household items to get these folks set up in about 3 weeks after we find out people are moving into homes.
Tara, that's amazing. 978-966.
978-266-2778. Please do call. We need lots of help, volunteers. Basically, our motto is, you call us, we get you working today.
We've got it, and it goes straight to the Gulf. Tara, we thank you for your call, and what an amazing story, amazing effort. Just organically, sounds, springing right up there. Neil Kinnegeier, Mario Flores, there's a lot more we want to hear, and we've got more voices coming in as well. Listeners, we're talking about the relief effort now, after that abysmal first response to Katrina, who's okay, who's not, and whether we're finally getting on top of it. You can join us. What are the big relief challenges here? After people are pulled off their rooftops and fed a few hot meals, is there a risk of national attention drifting away? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the relief effort now for Hurricane Katrina, the aftermath of the immediate aftermath, which didn't go so well. We want to look at who's okay, who's not, and whether the country is finally getting on top of this. You can join the conversation. Are you committed to following through for our fellow Americans in the Gulf? And what's most urgent there now? What are you hearing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in this hour by Neil Kinnegeier, CEO of Mercy Corps. They usually work internationally. Right now they've got a dozen people working in the Gulf Coast because the need this time is so great. And from Jackson, Mississippi, by Mario Flores, Director of Disaster Relief for Habitat for Humanity. He's worked in crises around the world, including in Indonesia after the tsunami there, in South Asia, Southeast Asia. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Mario Flores, that immediate housing problem that you're speaking of, how do you see that being addressed? I know you guys are looking further. You're looking for sites where houses will be built. But in the interim, where are people going to live for these next months while more permanent housing gets arranged?
Right. Well, as you know, the disaster relief efforts in the U.S. are coordinated by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, by FEMA. And one of the sources of temporary houses in past disasters had been, you know, the temporary housing schemes put together by FEMA, either by providing vouchers to stay in hotels or motels, or providing the FEMA, famous FEMA trailers, as they are called. Those are pretty much mobile homes that are put together in the very same places where families were living before. And those are some of the temporary housing solutions that we have seen in the past. Now, our concern is that, you know, after the media focus has moved away to the next big event or the next disaster, you know, thousands of families are left, you know, living in conditions of that are temporary. And that's where Habitat for Humanity is coming in, and we're really looking to the permanent recovery phase, where we can work with these families and with our own affiliates in building, you know, permanent solutions for those who were left homeless by the storm.
And as Neil Kinnegeier says, I suppose these things, at some point, they're going on at the same time. Relief housing and more permanent housing being developed, even while people are still in temporary quarters, obviously.
Exactly. And what Habitat is putting together, it's what we call the Operation Home Delivery. And we actually are not going to wait until conditions on the ground are ready to start building homes. Actually, we are working with our affiliates elsewhere in the country and also with community groups in the concept that we call house in a box or home in a box.
And is that permanent or temporary housing?
It's intended to be permanent housing. The way this works is that we're gonna be assembling the materials needed to build a house. And then working with these community groups, including our affiliates elsewhere in the U.S., and working together with volunteers, we will pre-build the frame of a home over a few days. Then this frame, this house, will be put together to ensure that we have, you know, the necessary solid fit. And then the frame will be taken apart and the components will be placed along with other necessary materials in a container. And then we will ship that container to an area along the Gulf Coast where, you know, families together with other volunteers and builders will open that container and will rebuild the house in its permanent location.
And there you go, a house in a box coming on the scene from Habitat for Humanity. Let me turn to a caller. Nancy is calling from Carlisle, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
This has been a really fascinating conversation, and I'm really glad you had this show. I'm just wondering while I'm listening, what it sounds to me like maybe there aren't, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
What are the principles that guide what public relief does versus what private relief organizations do? I don't mean to sound hard-hearted, but why am I giving money to the Red Cross to do emergency relief instead of having the billions of dollars that the federal government is spending go to what sounds like these are all really worthwhile and needed endeavors? I guess I don't understand how it gets parsed out.
I get the question because, on the one hand, here's this remarkable $830 million put out by Americans privately, and it sounds tremendous. Then you look, and Congress is talking about $60 billion. The president may see $200 billion tonight. It can make that look small. Let us look at that, Nancy, and thanks for your call. What goes where? To help us do that, let me turn to Washington. We're joined there by Scott Amey. He's general counsel of the Project on Government Oversight. It's a watchdog group. Scott, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, hello, Tom. Thank you.
Now, I don't know how wide your purview reaches here, but Nancy's saying, what's the line between what private donations do and what public money does in a situation like this? Can you speak to that, Scott?
I'm unsure what that line is as well. Here at the Project on Government Oversight, we're trying to ensure that the federal money that's being spent on the Katrina relief efforts and the reconstruction is spent wisely.
So you're looking purely at the government side of this?
That is correct, the federal government, yes.
Now, we've heard lobbyists in the last few days saying they're just shoveling money out the door, and we've seen these reports of firms with political contacts getting very big no-bid contracts. What's your sense on the public side of how that money's being dispersed and spent right now?
Well, we have quite a few concerns. The first one is with competition. There are a lot of non-competitive contracts that are being awarded, and we think that those should only be awarded in the most urgent circumstances. And for items or goods and services that can be considered non-urgent, then we need to wait a few days, even if it is a few days or a week or two, and see if we can get those awarded with competition. Transparency is another issue that we're having a lot of problems with. We're hearing about all this money being handed over. We've seen the $62.3 billion, and as you said earlier, we hear that it could go as high as $200 to $300 billion, but we're not seeing where the money's being spent. I would love for the government to actually create websites for every contract, agreement, grant money that they're turning over so we as the public and members of Congress can follow it.
But what about, I can imagine people in government saying, look at the drubbing we got for not moving straight in there in the days immediately after the storm. If you think we're going to slow down for a few niceties, now you're crazy. We're getting whipped here politically.
Well, POGO fully supports getting relief quickly to the people who are in need. I guess what we're really trying to focus in on is the things that don't need to be done immediately. Transparency can be added to the system. That's after the fact. We can have a website which shows where the money goes. Let's get the people the money that need it, but let's be able to follow it after the fact. Oversight, audits, all those things are going to be kind of post the reconstruction and the relief efforts where the money's spent, but let's make sure it's spent wisely. As you also said, the revolving door, there's questions about people's contacts with the Bush administration as well as the agencies that are granting money, are awarding money, and we need to follow those relationships as well to make sure that money isn't being steered to certain contractors over more competent and qualified contractors.
And you're talking there, POGO, as in your group, Project on Government Oversight. Neil Kinney-Geyer, what about our caller's question? She's kind of trying to say in a nice way, do they need my contribution to the private side if the government is letting loose this flood of cash in that direction? And what's the difference between how privately raised money gets spent and public money?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and the way that I like to think about it is the government money is really the
official response, and the bulk of that is going to go to restore transportation systems, to shore up the oil facilities, to deal with the mega infrastructure challenges that exist now after Hurricane Katrina.
And the president will no doubt speak to all that tonight, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow. But the other side of the equation?
But the other side of the equation, what the private relief effort does is it really goes to support these myriad of voluntary community-based initiatives and efforts that Mercy Corps, the Red Cross, and other organizations work with and support. That, and they're the backbone of the early stage of relief. They're what your caller talked about, that the auto angels can work with to ensure that people in shelters get the need. We can also test new ideas for recovery that a government agency simply can't test because of their bureaucracy. For example, how do we engage all of these inner-city, disaffected young people, some of whom engaged in lawlessness in New Orleans, in their own recovery efforts at a community level? Well, if you come in with a massive program and do it through a bureaucratic channel, you're probably not going to find effective ways to give people ownership over the recovery process. But a non-governmental organization, a community-based organization, can do that. And as we test these models and as they work, they can be scaled up by the official aid. That's why private assistance is so important. But I would say we need to have the same kind of accountability with the private aid that we do with the public aid, because whenever the American public reaches into their pockets so generously the way they have, they deserve to know that their money is being spent in an accountable, efficient manner.
More flexibility there. Let me get one more caller, if I may. Tom is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. A couple of anecdotes last night through an email, and I can quote this very briefly if you like. Laura is a Red Cross nurse in Mobile, Alabama. They processed 4,000 families in the past 2 days.
Okay.
They now work under guards, as some people are so exhausted and with such minimal food, shelter, and amenities that they are occasionally subject to random acts of violence. It sort of goes on.
This is a friend of yours who's working in the Red Cross in Alabama, you say?
That's correct. His wife is at the Red Cross Center for Mental Health in Bakersfield, California, where they have hired 300 workers in the past week who man phones for calls for assistance from all over the country.
Yeah.
If they hold up a blue card, it's a mental health crisis, and Kathy picks up the phone. Calls are coming in from shelters of all types, from official to hotels filled with people. A call comes in from a shelter, and it can last up to 6 hours as people at the shelters line up, and when one is done, the next person and the shelter gets on.
Wow, Tom, our time is running right down, but you paint a vivid picture. Let me ask, Neil Kinnegar, do you know about the ATM cards, the cash? Is that still happening? Are people being able to get cash to go out and buy a meal?
You know, in some cases they are, but my understanding is that that program has been significantly cut back. One thing we know for sure, it has not been a systematic-wide program. It started out, I think, as a great idea, and in this case, the private sector organized so that private business would be able to meet, you know, to respond to the needs of people through the ATM cards immediately after after Katrina hit. But it has not been extended in a wide-scale, efficient manner.
Well, we are going to continue following this in the days ahead. You can hear the interest, the passion among listeners to know what's going on, and we fully share that. We're grateful to each of you for your work in this time. Scott Amey with the Project on Government Oversight Watchdog Group there. Keep watching. We'll check in with you again.
Thank you.
Mario Flores with Habitat for Humanity. We wish you luck in finding places for those homes and more immediately for the houses in a box. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
And Neil Kinnegar, CEO of Mercy Corps. They usually work overseas. Right now, they are at work in the American Gulf Coast. Neil, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look ahead to the president's speech about rebuilding after Katrina. This is On Point. President Bush will address the nation tonight from New Orleans. He is expected to call for an unprecedented federal commitment to help rebuild the Gulf Coast. The $200 billion figure that is being floated would be more than has been spent on the Iraq War, and it would be the largest reconstruction effort ever on American soil. Bennett Roth is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. He joins me now from Washington. Bennett, thanks for being with us.
Hi.
So the president is in the region already, we hear. Where will he speak tonight exactly? Do you know?
Well, it's my understanding it's going to be Jackson Square in the French Quarter, which is known, very well known to many tourists who've been down there, and so it's a familiar landmark.
And what's the goal of the president's speech this evening?
Well, as an expert told me, there are two recovery efforts going on here. One is rebuilding New Orleans, and the other is resuscitating the president's reputation as a decisive leader, which took a real drubbing here. So I think he's trying to get up there in front of the nation and saying that, you know, I'm in charge and I'm going to steer the recovery in a way that's that the public approves of.
And are we talking a rhetorical grab to regain that momentum, or is he going to put a lot of beef on it? We're hearing this $200 billion number. That is a lot of money. We've heard calls to establish a kind of Marshall Plan for the region. Senator Ted Kennedy said early on, let's make it a Tennessee Valley Authority, kind of huge federal project. What's known about what the president may propose materially?
Well, he will not be that specific. There'll be no talk about a Marshall Plan or a TBA, but there will be talk about we'll do what it takes in terms of health care, education, infrastructure improvements, and I'm not even sure there'll actually be a dollar figure on there. He will just commit the federal government to funding various programs. Now, of course, the risk there is he will end up alienating many of his supporters who are not necessarily fans of big government.
There's been a call to go back to some of the spending bills that were passed over the summer and take out some of those line items for bridges to nowhere in Alaska and the like. Do you feel support for that kind of thing in Washington? If people don't want red ink, what about revisiting some of the pork that was offered up just weeks ago?
Well, there certainly are, and a number of the conservative think tanks and the Heritage Foundation, others have exactly called for that. However, when it gets down to it, many of these congressmen are not going to give up that transportation project in their district. I mean, what we think of pork, they say, is a necessary improvement. So that's the problem. When it actually gets down to the specifics, who is going to give up their program that's been approved?
And what about the president's political moment here? Maureen Dowd was writing yesterday saying, Mr. President, it's too late for that bullhorn moment like you had in Lower Manhattan. Give it up. Clearly the president not giving it up. He's going to be on the street there. What do you hear from the White House about his odds of getting that momentum back right now? New polls out today look worse than ever.
Right, and it's not. I don't think it's going to be one moment. I mean, everyone looks to that 9/11 moment where he put his arm around the firemen and said, you know, basically said the world or the terrorists will hear us. I think that moment has passed, and that was at least came across to the public as a spontaneous, genuine moment. And I do think he can't do that tonight. I mean, tonight will look very choreographed and scripted, but they believe it's a start. I mean, it actually started earlier this week with his sort of semi-apology or taking accountability for the problems, and this is going to go on to say, and this is what I'm going to do.
So the president standing up tonight in the French Quarter in New Orleans. Bennett Roth, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bennett Roth, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. He spoke with me from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Mary Moore, Matt Odette, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.